Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly Q&A topics and listener response episode.
Yeah. Stick around to the end. You're going to hear us announce what we're talking about in the first month of next year.
2024.
Can't believe it's already here. We're in the time of the year when every old person says, oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah. Just and let me be the first to say, oh boy.
Oh boy.
Oh boy. Got a good crop coming up.
Good so, crop. Yeah.
Keep an eye out. Also, we said it's our topics episode. Mm-hmm. It's another Oops All Questions, baby, this year, this month, because I didn't sleep. So, just peek behind the curtain. I got poo brain. I'm that the Ice King dressed up as the horse in Adventure Time. I got nothing.
It's easier to fit a bunch of small questions down the pipe than it is to fit one big one. So
right now the pipe is bad. I'm working on the pipe.
Yeah.
Non-horny. we have for patrons, we're recording our quarterly all topics very soon. So look out for that.
Yeah. Let's get started here with some follow-up on Adaptation Decay. That is a premium show that we do that doesn't have its own follow-up kind of thing, but this is interesting. We actually had two people write in about this because we called for clarification on it. Mm-hmm. So Robert writes, "Hey guys, I was just listening to the excellent Adaptation Decay on Biohazard the Stage. We covered for the last month of the strike, we covered a play in the Resident Evil universe. They continue, while I'm not a Japanese person, Japanese contemporary theater studies was a big part of my post-grad, and I thought I may be able to shed some light on this production. Biohazard can easily be categorized alongside stage musical adaptations of anime, which first started to take off in the mid-aughts. These generally feature younger actors with the hopes of gaining experience to graduate into something a bit more respected. Many are not the greatest singers, as spectacle and looks are valued over skill. As you may have guessed, these tend to be exploitative and tiring productions in which the actors are not well compensated. There's usually one or two bigger name cameos, in quotes, to lend credence, but these tend to be pop stars or voice actors. Sonny Chiba was a big get."
Sonny Chiba is in that.
Yes.
It's hard to ask anybody just like, hey, up your Patreon, but $10 a month gets you Adaptation Decay, which I think is one of our best shows. Mm-hmm. And there is a musical, or not a musical, a stage play of Resident Evil. That's an original story. That's canon that we covered. That's one of the more bonkers things we've ever done. And it has Sonny Chiba. I'm just giving that a little context there. Yeah. So it's each surprise is more surprising than the last when it comes to Resident Biohazard, the stage.
Yes. Usually running for a week or two, annualized performances tend to be a little bit rarer. Tickets are expensive, but even bigger venues tend to sell out because there are just that many otaku. The real money maker is the DVD sales. Video rentals remain illegal in Japan, so the DVDs are easily sold at an eye-watering $150 to $200 to the more dedicated and affluent fans. Stage adaptations of games are a little newer, first starting around the late 2000s, and just recently hitting full swing. Recently, there have been a number of successful Persona 4 and Persona 5 plays, and even a Steins Gate play, where the audience votes on the ending, like a collective visual novel. Nice. Funnily enough, one of the more respected and skillful productions is the 2009 all-women's Phoenix Wright musical. Anyway, love the ducks. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Want to give also some credit to Andrew C., mm-hmm. who wrote in through an email with a similar context for that, down to the price, which is about $75 for this. specifically. Yeah. They were in Japan at the time this came out.
Yeah. And saying this is part of a broader strategy called Media Mix, which is just, you know how we have like multimedia property kind of things. This gives you, it's taken to the extreme. Yeah.
It's why people in Japan get to have a Dragon Quest cafe and we don't.
Right.
Yeah.
And you call that context. Justice.
Yeah. And we call ourselves a good country. Big shout out to those two people. It's really nice when people add this additional context.
Yes.
We also, for Bonfireside Chat listeners, in the next episode, we'll be reading some additional context on the also bewildering manga. And when I say bewildering, I'm not trying to like lol wacky Japan any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. They are sincerely bewildering.
Even the creator says, I've got no idea how this is.
Yeah, this is really, we know this is weird. Yeah. It's one of the greatest things about having an audience.
Yeah.
You know, we're recording this on the eve of Duckstream, basically, which is the best thing about having a large audience. Mm-hmm. The second best thing is being able to just kind of pull a wide variety of people to fill in holes in your knowledge mm-hmm. base.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love it. Last little bit of follow-up here before we get into the questions. Troy has an Amnesia the Bunker comment. Hey, fellas, I'm surprised you have minimal comments for Amnesia the Bunker, so I'm going to throw one in here. Better late than never.
You mispronounce hey, fellas.
Oh, hey, fellas. Hey, fellas. There we go. I was getting confused as to which hey. I got the game based on your recommendation for the Halloween season. Up front, I want to say I enjoyed the shit out of the game. But in the first couple hours of playing, the game kept crashing on me. It was so bad, I almost had to quit it, and almost did because I had Baldur's Gate 3 on deck, just eyeballing me in my game library. But thankfully, some bugs were fixed, and I was able to complete it. The sound design was spectacular, so much so that I think it really made the playthrough experience top tier. All the systems working together, as you mentioned, was a thrill to navigate. You need to go slow and not alert the monster, but you need to go fast to get shit done with the generator still running. So fun. I think I died like 70 or more times. The recap of stats at the end of the game is cool. Not sure if you discussed that part. Thank you very much for the recommendation. Looking forward to Real Lich Hours. Woo!
Thank you, Ric Flair.
Yeah. thank you. Thank you, fella. Good to have comments on that very good game, which want more people to play.
Love it. Getting into game questions here, Dylan writes, do y'all have any names for RPG protagonists that you often use? I use Sven, after the name my grandfather used when playing Final Fantasy in the 80s. His favorite game was Final Fantasy Legend, in which your character can permanently die if you exhaust all of your revives. According to my grandmother, this World War II veteran got so attached to his character Sven in Final Fantasy Legend that he refused to play it ever again after Sven permanently died, and my grandfather accidentally saved over his file. That's actually how I got all of his Game Boy games. He was that upset. He's been gone for 20 years, but I still love booting up a new RPG with Sven.
Hey, Dylan, greatest generation.
Hey, that is an incredibly sweet story. Thank you for sharing that.
That's very cute. I also love that there's probably a 4-character limit in that game. I will do Garen, which is just my name with N at the end, if it's a fantasy game. The last couple times I've played a CRPG, I have made a version of my current tabletop character.
Okay.
Tabletop, who's named Kribbis.
Kribbis.
Kribbis, who's a real piece of shit. Slicked back hair, tight white jeans. So I if I'm going to play kind of a shithead.
Yeah.
Not the shithead I'm going to play in Real Lich Hours, who is a genocidal monster. Because Dark Urge.
I don't really have a standard that I go with, just wherever the mood takes me.
I'll also do Gary some frequency.
It depends on how much it feels like it'll fit in the world.
it's a weird thing. Like it's really whether the weather strikes me, whether I care about that. Like it's if the game feels like it wants it. Like if I'm playing one of the harebrained scheme Shadowrun games, you're not being asked to come up with a name. You're being asked to come up with a Shadowrunner handle, which is very cool. Like that's a creative exercise. Yeah, that's not just naming a dude.
That's a much better assignment.
Yes. Yeah. So there it varies.
Mm-hmm.
Bo says, I recently finished Blasphemous 2, and while still not a triumph like Environmental Station Alpha or Hollow Knight, I thought it was an improvement on most facets of its predecessor. However, for many of the side quests, I instinctively hit a point where I was done exploring for collectibles by myself and opened up a location map to round up the straggling doodads and whatnots. Unlike those games that breathe with real wind in their chest, Blasphemous 2 remained something like a toy to me. My investment in the game wasn't high enough to act like I was living in the world instead of just playing inside it. Do you find that there's a difference in how you'll play a game if you aren't fully immersed or drawn to it, maybe just merely enjoying it? Or rather, what causes you to go into a game like a Traveler Lost instead of a guided tourist? Thanks. Yeah, kind of ties into the last thing.
It does.
Like, whether you're going to roleplay. Mm-hmm. Play pretend. This is something I wish I could name for just me personally. I wish I could name elements of the game, but really it's probably down to like how much sleep and blood sugar I have when I start the game. You know, it's just mood.
We are all subservient to our circumstances to some degree.
It's probably meter related if I had to guess. Like there are games that definitely don't earn it.
Yeah.
You know, where I'm just like, I'm not going to pretend to be in this. This is too, too artificial and silly feeling.
Yeah.
You know, but like, I think about something like Hollow Knight, which I loved, but I also did not, you know, I didn't do all the collectibles in that either.
No.
Like, I love that game, you know, but I didn't, you know, I just, that's just not going to be me. And it had nothing to do with it feeling like a real world. Mm-hmm. I just, that's always going to feel artificial.
Yes.
To me, no matter how real the world feels. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's based on either just like mood and then also what the activity is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, immersion is the wrong, like it's not the word for the thing that I am chasing. However, like, I think that a lot of it also has to do with how discoverable things are just by interacting in the world versus looking at some element of the interface too.
Yeah.
You know, something that makes Elden Ring sing for me compared to something like Horizon is that like I can, wherever I'm standing, like, you know, to press the right stick and find something real cool that I want to run toward. And then from that, I can press the right stick and see something real cool that I want to run toward, and accumulate things naturally there with a good number of games, you know, open world or otherwise. If I am relying on the to-do list or the map inside, it starts to feel a little bit more like like a checklist.
It's a way, it's how quickly you can see the bounding box of possibility.
Yeah.
You know, that is the difference between Elden Ring and Horizon, right?
Yeah.
Like in Elden Ring, it felt like, even though this is not true, it did a better job of the illusion of feeling like anything could be over a corner.
Yeah.
You know, or around a corner, over a hill. Whereas Horizon, like it just, I knew it was going to be there. A guy told me to go there to collect 10 doodads.
Yeah.
You know, it's too video gamey. Mm-hmm. Like, and with something like the reason why Hollow Knight, as much as I love that game and love that world, doesn't really inspire that in me is partly because it's from the side.
Yeah.
You know, it has platforms that are made to jump on, and I can't unsee the geometry of like the math of this platforming challenge, which wouldn't exist in real life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how quickly I can see that bounding box. Can you see it that it's a game easily?
Yeah. Good question. Ethan writes, howdy. Have either of you played Armored Core 6 yet? Just completed the third and final ending. Feeling a little confused, and I hope to hear your thoughts on the story, as I felt there was a lot going on between multiple characters, aligning this way and that way, as well as some solid writing, elevated by some well-characterized vocal performance. Bonus question, favorite horror movie?
Did you stick with Armored Core 6?
No, I bounced to other stuff. I did other stuff instead.
Yeah. I have not played it. Mm-hmm. Favorite horror movie is tough.
Yeah.
Like I love horror movies. I think The Thing is probably the best horror movie, but I don't know if it's my favorite.
Yeah, you know? That's the thing. Like best and scariest are difficult questions, I think, to answer.
The most visceral I felt watching a horror movie was the first time I watched Hereditary.
Yeah.
And Hereditary is really up there for me. Like in search of a better answer, that may as well be it.
No.
It's either that or maybe In the Mouth of Madness, which is, you know, also John Carpenter. But I like that more than The Thing, even though I think it's a worse movie.
Yeah.
It just ticks more in my boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Horror movie that I could sit down like and watch right away. Doesn't matter what. Like, I don't know. Give me Resolution Endless or Something in the Dirt. you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Something in the Dirt's really up there as well. Like that's a really great movie.
Yep. Plenty of good horror movies. Unfilmable. Listen to it.
Yeah. Also, this is the story advertised for our Patreon. If you haven't joined us, if you go to patreon.com/techfeedtv, you get a bunch of bonus shows.
You do.
Naveen asks, what are your thoughts on the homogeneity of gaming platforms and hardware? We're a long way from the days when the consoles and PCs had distinct libraries due to varying capabilities and different input devices. Nowadays, the experience is 90% the same, regardless of platform. And while it's great we can all play the same games, it does feel like something was lost from those days when a game was designed to the strengths of a specific platform. Is there anything you miss from the old days where CD quality sound or dual screen made for a unique experience? I'm going to be a philistine and say no. The romantic answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Right. The capabilities have become similar, which is why things aren't designed to the that's why this happened. It's a cart falling horse thing.
Yeah,
like the days of games being built to the capabilities of systems coincided exactly with the capabilities of systems becoming largely the same.
Yeah.
And if I want like a novel experience, there's VR now, which is the closest thing. Generally, I really like that I can just choose the medium in which I play a game for the most part. Mm-hmm. I don't have to own an Xbox. Which I love.
The last major barrier, I think, that was broken down that made this feel definitely true, that things are kind of homogenous, is there being basically very little distinction between playing something on a console or a PC and handheld.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that made that possible fucking rules. Like, the Switch fucking rules. The Steam Deck rules.
All so, of this stuff is good. To me, it just seems unquestionably good.
Uh-huh.
The
thing that I miss is not being advertised to every time I wanted to turn on a game device.
I love looking at an ad for the Doritos Super Bowl every time I played Rock Band.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of those hardware specific things I kind of hate. Mm-hmm. And that's the non-romantic answer. Like, people are going to go to bat for old DS games and gimmicks. For the Wii stuff like that. I never liked that. I love a control stick and a button. Rhythm Heaven on the DS is my favorite entry in that series because of the songs.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the gimmick. I would just as soon press a button.
Mm-hmm.
Dual screens don't help me. Waggling. I hate waggling. Like, it's the thing that makes me not want to go back to Mario Galaxy very much.
Yeah.
It's just not good to me. My muscles aren't made for it. I've been pressing buttons my whole life. It feels natural doing these other things. It doesn't add a whole lot, in my opinion.
It's neat that stuff still exists. I still have it in my house if I want to go back to it. Despite that availability, I very often do not. It's fine. It is okay that can be relegated to some form of history.
It's a sometimes treat.
Yeah.
It's like how I will most of the time, if I want to listen to a record, I'll just throw it on Apple Music or listen to it on YouTube while I'm working on my computer. Every once in a while, I will put on a vinyl.
Yeah.
It's a sometimes treat. I'm still getting the same songs, though.
Yep.
And I don't, I'm not a purist in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Abram writes, what do you all think of tabletop adventure modules? Do you have any favorites that you've read or run? Have you ever thought of doing a monster in my podcast style fast and loose look at them? With the old school revival still rocking on, there's a lot of fun and wild adventures out there, many of them in that 32-page or less range.
No new shows right now.
we're
full up. We're super full up. Shadow of the Erdtree trailer might drop any day now. We're full up, but I think we both like those.
Oh yeah,
A lot.
Oh, definitely. Never played a single one, but I've got a bunch of them.
I've played some. I've definitely owned way more than I played. I recently organized my bookshelf, so I'm looking at my tabletop RPG collection right now, and there's tons of modules in it. I love reading a module. I love old dungeon magazines.
Yep.
This stuff's great to me. Mm-hmm. So it would be fun to go through them. Big shout out to a YouTube. I've always wanted a YouTube channel that does that. Mm-hmm. There is one. It's called DM It All. They don't put out things very often, and they also dabble in other stuff. But from time to time, they're just like, here's what the module, the original Ravenloft module was.
Yeah.
You know, if you went through it, it's kind of like a walkthrough explainer.
Nice.
Real into it. I want way more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As for favorites, never, you know, haven't played one, but like, I don't know, ones that I've read, it's real hard to mess with Tatters of the King.
Yeah. Right? Tatters of the King is great. That's super good. I ran and read Horror on the Orient Express, the very long Call of Cthulhu campaign. That's really good. And then Shadowrun wise, I really like Universal Brotherhood, which is the original Bug City is the source book. It's not an adventure necessarily.
Yeah.
Universal Brotherhood is how they introduced the bug spirits to Shadowrun, and it's really strong.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Even like recent stuff, the 5e Icewind Dale Rime of the Frost Queen or something like that is real good.
Maiden, yeah.
Yeah, Maiden of the Frost Queen, yeah.
The weird thing, like everyone hates 5e D&D and everyone hates Wizards of the Coast now and fair. The actual quality of those books I really enjoy to read. I have no idea how they're game balanced, but the Guide to Ravenloft and the Curse of Strahd are both fun reads.
Yes.
I haven't cracked into the Planescape one yet. I feel a little bad about that. I've just been busy.
It's a little daunting.
It's just a GTA 5 Mass Effect back-to-backer, you know, that kind of got me. But I'm looking forward to doing that over winter break.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Viva.
Yeah.
Love this stuff. Actually, Facebook Marketplace kept advertising there was a thrift store, secondhand shop in the suburbs. They're like, hey, somebody, we have tons and tons of old D&D modules. Somebody came in and sold a bunch of them. And I was like, shit, gotta go. And then stuff just kept coming up. And eventually went a couple weeks ago, and they had sold out almost everything.
Okay.
And what was left was real price to stay. It was a real bummer.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Missed my shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jared says, do you have any formative video game memories from early childhood? I watched my cousin play Resident Evil 1 on PS1 when I was 5 and had nightmares about it for 7 years. I even led a prayer at a family gathering that ended with, and please help me stop dreaming about Steven's scary video game. God ignored that prayer so hard that not only did I stop believing in him, I still can't get through Resident Evil 1 to this day. Thanks for making me a yellow-bellied heathen, Capcom. Praying to God won't help. They should just put that on the back of Resident Evil.
Yeah.
The praying to God won't help cut.
Your God won't help you hear. Yeah. Jared.
We found somebody to do the soundtrack who is even deafer.
That's only the director's cut.
I know. Well, they're saying this is the praying to God won't help cut.
Okay.
It's right, even further. Yes.
Yeah. I really commend your bravery in sharing that story, Jared.
Yeah. That's dorky. That's great. Yeah. And God ignored it because,
Yeah.
What's he going to do? He just like looked down at the cloud and went, pussy.
For formative video game memories, there's obviously like, watching my brother play Mario or whatever. Definitely the first time I rented, I was even older than this. I wasn't 7. I must have been like 12. Renting Silent Hill, playing the intro where you get up to the crucified body and the little kid demons attack you, been like, nope. Then taking it back to the rental place, taking it back to the Kmart, in order to rent something else because it was too much.
Yeah. Spooky.
Yeah.
I got no scary, memories from the kids. My earliest gaming memories were playing Joust, on Atari. With my family, pre-divorce, so this would have been before I was 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have very strong memories of staying up really late and going through dungeons and Dragon Quest.
Okay.
And that really weird, sparse, scary music.
Oh, yeah.
That plays in that, being, you know, a little unnerving, but also just very transfixing.
God. Just that, like, that one sparse track and then the two tiles that made up those dungeons, brick and not brick.
Yeah, yeah. With the light thing. It kind of works. Like, it just, you know, I don't want to go back and play Dragon Quest.
No.
Now, but in terms of a vibe for a kid, Mm-hmm. Like, it was very effective.
An interesting game, not a good game, that I think made a lot of that kind of feeling. It's called The Nameless Game on DS. It's a horror game that goes back and forth between you're playing like a haunted Dragon Quest alike, and then there are like first person horror, like exploration things where like stuff from it is breaking into the real world. You know, it's not a good game. It's an interesting game, but yeah.
Sounds neat.
Let's see. Greg says, it's never been confirmed by Nintendo, but it's widely believed that Nintendo had a Switch Pro ready to go for wide-scale release in 2020 before the pandemic and all of the supply chain issues that resulted in the killing of the project. We know, looking at Sony and Microsoft, that it wasn't really until about late 2022 that you started to easily find PlayStations and Xboxes 2 years after release. So perhaps this was the right choice for Nintendo, who made a killing. However, it looks like it will be at least a couple of years now before Nintendo's next system is ready to replace the Switch. The Switch is badly showing its age by now. Many new games are not coming out on it, and Nintendo may struggle due to all of this. To reclaim its lead when the new system comes out. Do you feel Nintendo made the right decision in killing the Switch Pro or not releasing any kind of upgrade to the Switch?
I don't know. This is going to be a cop out, but I'm the wrong person to ask, like, business stuff, especially with my current poo brain this morning. I have no business mind right now. For me, if the Switch never gets better and it's just a place to play indie games, it would still make me happy. You know, the AAA stuff I played on it, or the bigger stuff I played on it, played fine for my taste. I have the Steam Deck for tougher stuff. Like, go back to that earlier question about the homogeneity. Like, I can play Mario Wonder on it, which I can only play on that, and it runs great.
Yes.
You know, so I'm happy kind of regardless. And in my current brain state, that's as far as my forecasting can go.
Like, as far as the analysis. Yeah.
Are my needs being met? If so, okay.
It was just recently that the Switch sold more units than the Wii did. Like, whatever Nintendo did or does, it will be it's the right thing for for them to have done and continue to do. Like, whatever they release next will probably be outdated compared to whatever, if anything, Sony and Microsoft put out. It was not a cloud streaming box or whatever. And for me personally, basically what you said. Stuff I can play stuff on Switch that doesn't run on anything else and still looks good to me. So that's fine.
It's part of it is just the perspective I take towards games, where like I'm never chasing a horizon. You know, like, I always have infinite things to play. There's always a lot of stuff. You know, I never beat Underrail. You know, I got like 20 hours into that. I'd love to have time to go back to that. Part of that's the job. Part of it is just a relaxed attitude and a wide array of tastes. You know, someone in the Slack reminded me of Rogue Legacy 2, which I meant to check out. You know, all kinds of things. Like, I'm fine. You know, so people being like, man, this console generation is getting up there. We really need a new one, which isn't what Greg's saying, but it's an attitude I've seen. I just don't relate to it. You know, it feels like a different world. To me, you know, and no hate and no disrespect for people who do feel that way. It's just it's a different relationship to games than I have.
Do you want to jump to other question types?
Let me scroll on down. Give me just a moment.
Got KL got a life with question questions.
Here. KL here. KL says, what are your worst failures of cooking? I thought the time I made cookies and forgot the flour
was my all.
Yeah, that's the main thing in cookies. forgot the flour was my all-timer until this weekend, when I discovered that if you don't use enough confectioner's sugar to make royal icing, it looks exactly like human semen. icing doesn't look unlike human sisy. Also, royal icing does look like human semen. More or less, kind of regardless. So don't be too hard on yourself. Like,
I don't know if this is the worst, but one time I ruined a whole bunch of bacon. I was cooking it, and then I was just fucking around with the spatula, and I was cooking it on real high heat on cast iron, and melted half of a spatula into like a half pound of bacon.
You walked away on that bad boy.
I think I was just like, I was trying something where just instead of like flipping it, I was like scraping it around on there to like kind of get it over, you know, get it like real nice and curly, like render the fat, you know?
Yeah.
It was like a half pound of bacon gone. Due to melted and spatula. Yep.
Yeah.
No, actually, I still have the spatula. It's real good for flipping small stuff.
Okay. Because it's got that little melted pointed end. Yeah.
Yep.
For tiny pancakes. This is not a brag. I'm a pretty good cook. Mm-hmm. I can't make food that would like present to the queen or whatever.
Right.
But I can make things that taste good to me and the people I feed.
Yeah.
My biggest failures are, and I don't use recipes.
Right.
Which is why I feel like I fuck up less because of that. Mm-hmm. Like I'm just kind of doing stuff to it until it tastes good.
Yeah.
My biggest issue is I will oversalt things from time to time. I have made food too salty to eat. I've also made food too spicy to eat.
Yes.
So over seasoning without a guide is when I will fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I've definitely had to rescue too spicy chili by breaking it into two sub.
Sub chilies. Yeah. Two sub chili starters.
Yep.
Yeah. Like that you then put in a mason jar in your fridge to grow more chili. Everyone got into chili making during the pandemic. So everyone was trading chili starters. You missed your shot.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah. No, I got some real good.
I've done that as well before. And it's like, well, fuck, you know, I guess I just have to make more chili, but then you'll try to fuck with it by like adding cream or something, or adding like a cream element. Mm-hmm. Sweetness will cut spice.
Yeah, but only so much before becomes, you know.
And then it becomes something in like a spicy dessert chili. Like, it's like soft serve. It's like, there's so much honey in this. It's more or less like you spread on toast. Like, this is repulsive.
I've tried using chocolate to rescue a chili like that.
Yeah. It can be a fun problem.
From
time to time, you know, but it is and every once in a while you end up with something very good. Mm-hmm. Like I've made things that are too spicy and added sweet elements that you wouldn't expect.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually been really good.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, this goes together well. Like I was not expecting this like African stew to taste good with this much sweet in it. But it's actually really tasty. But every once in a while you just get something inedible.
You know what I found that can save something like too spicy? Like if I'm doing like a slow cook something. Well, the actual thing is acid. Keep lemon juice or lime juice around. Just zap that bad boy.
Yeah, acid's a hack anyway.
Yeah.
I add yellow mustard to chili. Like not tons, but if I'm making a batch, I add a little bit of mustard. And I add a little vinegar. To basically anything. Like you want that to wake things up. Yeah. Like the 101 level lesson is that if your food is asleep, you need salt. And then the 201 level lesson is acid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What does Doug say?
Doug says, this is a media question. We got a lot of media questions this time. What is a piece of media you consumed when you were younger that was foundational to your sense of right and wrong and why?
Yeah, wow.
Hmm. Profound.
Not sure. It's hard for me to think about that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a good question. I watched all the normal stuff. Like I watched Sesame Street and Zoobly Zoo, Reading Rainbow, and all the kids stuff that teaches you right and wrong.
No.
You know, but I don't remember specific lessons from it. I don't have a direct connection.
Yeah. There's probably a read on my life experience where you can trace my intolerance for oppression back to being a real big fan of Disney's Robin Hood.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my Disney movie as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, for sure. Like, that's the one I watched all the time. And that also has class overtones, you know. I get it's funny because it pops up a lot, you know, when you do therapy and stuff too. Tying specific attitudes to childhood things and the nature of my childhood. This is not a sympathy play, but the nature of my childhood is like a lot of that stuff is just a big hazy cloud that I don't think about a whole lot, you know? So it's really hard for me to remember specific things.
Yeah.
This is super personal, but like at one point with an ex, we were doing like we're having problems and we're doing like this workbook, like working through stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to do like at home counseling stuff. And a lot of the questions were like, what was a ritual you had as a child? And how did it make you feel? And like my answer to all those, like, I don't fucking know, you know, like, and it's an honest answer. I'm not, you know, putting on, it just, I search my files for that and nothing comes up, you know, and it ended up actually, because that was a bad relationship and needed to end, ended up becoming like also a fight.
Oh,
you know,
because
I was like, I'm, you know, I'm being honest. I don't have an answer for this.
She thought you were sandbagging. Yeah.
She thought I was sandbagging. And like, I wish I was fucking sandbagging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I just don't, there's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, even if I get proper sleep and I have good brain, like, there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. So I just don't kind of don't have files where that should be.
Yeah.
Personally.
And I, like, this is going to sound sappy or whatever. Like, a lot of my sense of right and wrong came from my dad, you know?
Yeah.
Came from my dad and my grandma and grandpa, which sounds like a real rough burn on my mom.
Like, she was teaching me how to smoke.
Yeah.
At the time they were teaching me to be right and wrong. She was teaching me how to boost cars.
On the rough shit. We called her street mommy.
Yeah, I learned how to make prison shivs from prison mom.
Yeah. I did learn an awful lot about prison life from my mom. It's just like that stuff more comes, you know, comes from family, not in like Leave It to Beaver ways, but just in very specific,
well, that's what they're supposed to do. Like, yeah, that's the purpose of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
at the very least. Yeah. Yeah. No, the very least is food, clothing, and shelter. Yeah. But,
but that's the next, that's the dual one.
Yeah. Yes.
Eli asks, hey guys, Magnolia has always been used as shorthand on the network, and though I kind of gleaned what you meant, I finally watched it sort of recently. With the return of Best Quality Vacuum, I've been re-listening to that show and listening to the season 2 episodes, and I'm left wondering, do you guys like Magnolia? Personally, I loved it. The Goodbye Stranger scene is a particular highlight, but it's way too goddamn long. obligatory, thanks for the shows. And it's actually obligatory. obligatory. But I corrected it in my head. To its detriment.
Yeah.
That is a purposeful misspelling. I'm not making fun of Eli.
Yes. I also love da shows. And if everybody can say obligatory, da shows,
thanks
that
for
way.
Da shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never seen Magnolia. I know it. I know it by reputation. I know what you're like. I know what you mean when you say, hey, this is way too Magnolia. We should probably define that for folks.
We got to do another Dictionary at some point.
Yeah, we got to. We,
yeah,
we
gotta
really,
finish that
really
project,
do.
Because we use a lot of shorthand, and it's bad podcasting. Magnolia is a P.T. Anderson movie. It is about a large group of people whose lives are connected, whose lives affect one another and interconnect in unexpected ways. So, you know, that's the movie.
I think a better version of the non-Cronenberg crash movie is my understanding.
Yes, like way better than that, or like Boogie Nights, if all those people didn't necessarily know each other.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's P.T. Anderson's trick in a lot of ways. I love Magnolia. I think it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't seen it in a long time. The last time I saw it, I might have watched it on two VHS tapes.
Nice.
Like one of those two-part VHS tapes.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I do enjoy Magnolia. I love P.T. Anderson.
Yeah.
So, yeah. One of my favorite filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. That answers the question. I haven't, and you have. Kyle writes, what is your favorite media you can't recommend to people in good conscience, be it for content or other reasons? For me, I love the Wheel of Time books, but recommending a 15-book series to a fellow human being is basically an act of violence in and of itself. I'm real happy that we've made our entire audience super gun shy about recommending anything.
Yeah. We're influencing humanity in a profoundly negative way on accident, in this normal thing to do. Like the fear in Will's voice when he thinks I might be accusing him of recommending something. And he's just like, hey, I'm not recommending it. I don't recommend things to you. And I'm like, man, I know you're doing the work. I appreciate it. It's just hard because, you know, there is a way, there's like good recommendations and bad recommendations.
Yeah.
You know, the good recommendation is, I know you really well. Mm-hmm. I think you would really like this. I'm not putting any pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
I just think you'd dig it if you're looking for something. The end.
Yep.
That's a good recommendation. The bad recommendation is, hey, I really like this. I really want someone to talk to about it. You should really do this. Why aren't you doing this? Like, that's the bad recommendation. And
the recommendation check-in is really something.
Have you done that thing yet?
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't make this into work because I won't do it. Like, you're just making this, you're making me less likely to check it out, you know? Mm-hmm. There's lots of things I don't recommend. I don't recommend most stuff I like because it just, like, it's singular, right? Like, I don't expect anybody to give a shit about, like, the X-Men, or we're talking about source books. Like, I'm not going to go to just one of my friends who likes stuff and be like, you know, hey, you should really ring, Tatters of the King.
Yeah.
You know, like, no, they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. They have no context for it. Like, it's really good. I really like it, you know, but I would rather just, like, tell them the cool thing about it and then let them come to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alan Moore, Lovecraft stuff. I don't recommend Lovecraft stuff in general. I don't recommend, I like all that stuff, but I don't usually do it, you know, for content.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I don't know. It's hard to recommend to people to play Pathologic, even though I think that is a very good game that has a lot to say. Both mechanically and narrative wise, but just because it's hostile, like I could say like, hey, you should play this thing that you're absolutely going to hate. Gets a little bit complicated that way. And then, you know, like monster reasons, like, I don't know. I don't talk about like in Chinatown an awful lot because it's made by the monster.
By a monster.
Yeah. Well,
and there's also things where it's like, do we need another white guy talking about Chinatown?
Nope, not
Which
at
is
all.
The same thing that pops up. Like, we're doing a show on Breaking Bad, so we're both guilty of that. That's not me calling you out. But that's the same thing when I tell somebody about Deadwood or The Wire. Or any of these, you know, great pieces of TV that I do genuinely think are really good. You know, but in my experience, I am very curious if somebody is a consummate recommender. I would like to know, in a non-challenging way, like non-rhetorical way, if they enjoy receiving recommendations, if they act on them, and if the people that they recommend things to respond well.
Yeah.
Because in my experience, whenever I am like, you know, Deadwood's awesome, like, I think you'd really like it, people are just like, okay, and then they just move, they act like I would act. They don't go like, oh shit, I'm going to move that to the top of my queue.
Right.
They just go about their life and watch the things they were going to watch anyway.
Yeah.
You know, like recommendations are weird. I think that, you know, we were joking about it in the beginning of this question. I think that you and I are unusually hostile to it, but not that unusually hostile to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that there is a pretty good, you know, a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah. Also, recommendations are poison is a thing that we say almost entirely when we are about to recommend something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like, we also turn that on ourselves as well.
Yeah.
You know, we're disclaiming because we disclaim a lot. And we're disclaiming because we don't want anyone to feel any pressure about it. Like, we're not here to give anybody homework. You know, so. Yeah. Yeah. And also, we don't know anybody's taste. Like, we're doing it on a podcast. We're not talking to a person we know. We can say, like, hey, this game is really good, but I don't know the person listening's taste.
You know? Yeah. We're not speaking specifically to you, John, when we talk about this.
Yeah.
I know Kyle asked the question, but any Johns out there, we're not saying you in particular need to do this when we say something's good.
Yes.
It's usually in context of, you know, talking about what we're talking about.
And even when the nice thing is you and I have a real understanding about each other with that, because even though we do know each other's taste and have successfully recommended things to one another, you and I are ginger with that because we understand that the other person's probably just going to be like, I had other stuff I was going to look at. I'm going to do that. You know, I'm managing 1,000 meters at any given moment, and also I'm busy.
Yeah.
You know, I can't like I think you would like Magnolia. Does that mean, you know, I don't think you have to drop everything and watch it, though. It doesn't clear the bar of, like, it's a crime you haven't watched it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
So it's less anything inherent to a work itself that makes us not want to, like, immediately go to bat for it. You know, see the examples we saw before, but just generally the process of recommending something to anybody. You know, modern life is just a constant, just a constant deluge of recommendations anyway. Like, literally every piece of information we see, you know, specifically digitally, is, you know, shaped to try and, you know, meet us where we are or whatever. Like, we're always being recommended stuff. Why add to the noise?
Yeah. Ben asks, The semi-recent news that Fables author Bill Willingham was attempting to make his comics public domain led me to discovering that he holds some pretty vile right-wing views. Why do you think the comics industry, compared to other forms of art, has such a prevalence of awful people? Is Alan Moore onto something with his superheroes are fascist power fantasies comments? I don't know if I think comics are worse than other mediums in this respect. Bill Willingham sucks. Frank Miller sucks. Ethan Shiver sucks. Like, there are a lot of people who fucking sucks. There's Comics Gate. But, like, have you seen other mediums?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I bet you it's similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could say the same thing about stand-up comedy, right?
Yeah. Like, which, you know, like people don't get... You don't lose your job for masturbating in front of your coworkers in stand-up comedy. You can say the same thing for video games.
Yeah.
You know, you can say, I'm not trying to sound offensive. I just feel like this is little in the water. I hate that Bill Willingham has those beliefs because I liked Fables. Mm-hmm. And I think trying to make that public domain was baller.
Yes.
The dude has awful right-wing views, but the idea of somebody just being like, this modern work is actually public domain, I'm giving it away, is something I would love to see way more of.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's super cool.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I think it can also be, you know, knowing nothing about the industry, really. But, like, when I think about comics creators, they don't generally, like, talk, really.
A lot of times, no. Like, only in their own weird little... garden. Like, there are websites and there's the Comics Journal, but that is a drop in the bucket.
They're not necessarily like personalities who are out there, you know, unless you are an Alan Moore who people specifically go to torment.
Gotta find out what he thinks about Marvel movies. I will hound him until the end of his days, this old man. We gotta know.
Yeah. As for superheroes being inherently fascist power fantasies, I don't know that that's inherent to it. I think that maybe that was more prevalently true in past eras or whatever. But then again, I don't know an awful lot about like modern superhero comics. Right.
Alan Moore is speaking. I love Alan Moore. He's speaking from a position of intense bitterness of him making a critique of that and having it taken entirely unironically.
Yes.
Which is understandable. Mm-hmm. I think that superhero comics are inherently anything is like almost any medium where like you need to read more of the thing if you want to hold that opinion.
Yeah.
You know, like there are, you know, the same way that there are movies that are fascist power fantasies.
It's like, it's kind of like saying, oh, anime is inherently pervy. Like,
exactly. Well? Yeah. You know, exactly. It's the same thing. And like, that's why, you know, my quest to be more specific in my vocabulary with that.
Yeah.
You know, and even shown in anime, I don't think is inherently pervy.
Right.
It just has tropes I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
But there are deconstructions of that the same way there are deconstructions of superheroes. But go back to the recommendation thing. Like, just because that's true, if somebody reads a superhero comic and they're like, this is a fascist power fantasy, I don't want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's worth their time trying to find the exceptions to that.
Yeah.
I can feel comfortable that they exist. You know, because I have knowledge of that, but I don't.
Yeah.
It's not worth their effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And just if they're starting from a deficit, saying, "Hey, I definitely don't like this thing," proving them wrong, or let's see recommendations. You know.
Who cares if they're wrong?
Yeah.
Like letting people be wrong is the hardest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult for me. I wish I was better at it, but it is. The struggle is worth it.
Unless somebody's coming at me saying that I'm a bad person for liking something, unless it's a confrontation that they're making about it, it's,
confrontation, right, because a lot of times it's not a confrontation.
Right.
Like this, one of the reasons why I will get sensitive about, if I say I don't like a thing and then people take it personally.
Right.
One of the reasons why I don't like that is that living through a superhero comics and movies are awful. Period in life right now or in media, which is fine. Like it doesn't get it, but I don't know, I don't feel defensive about this comment,
you know,
and it's like, oh, this is a thing I care a lot about. I just know that that's not true of all of them. And that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's talking about me or reflecting on me.
Yeah.
Cause I'm self-actualized. It's great.
Yeah.
Do it.
tends to smooth a bunch of stuff out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not the media you consume.
Yep.
People talking about media are not talking about you. The end. There's no exceptions.
Let's see here. Jordan or Maya writes, hey, cool guys. I just had to drive from Illinois to Tennessee, and the passenger in charge of the aux cord decided to play a playlist of the worst songs ever. Real fun time, as you would expect. What is the worst song y'all have ever heard? What is your favorite? What is your favorite song that people generally hate?
I love this question. This is me and the bandmates do this all the time. We talk about shitty songs constantly. This is not the real worst one. It's just recency bias. I was reminded of the song Black Velvet.
Oh, God.
Recently. And that is a real gross song. It's kind of about Elvis, but it's also a real sexy, sultry song about how you can see black velvet in a little boy's smile. And stuff. It's real horny. And real gross and real repetitive and just like slinky and slimy in a nasty way. I hate that song.
I've got real bad associations with that because in times when I was doing like more karaoke.
Oh God.
Just like, just there'd be some, and I'm very sorry. There'd be some women who would just get up and then just rock a real, just like low energy bummer of a country song. So they could belt out around it. And it's just like the sheer amount of devastation that you are doing to the energy of the room by getting up there and hitting that. That's I can't brook it. It's real rough.
The person who knowingly does the song that has like a 3-minute solo, you know, that kind of shit. The real answer to this might be Pretty Fly for a White Guy.
Bad. Which
that's an excruciating song. The Bad Touch, excruciating. What is it? The Cherry Pop and Daddy song that isn't Hell, or no, that's Scroll and Zippers. The Cherry Pop and Daddy song.
You're thinking of Zoot Suit Riot.
Zoot Suit Riot's real rough. There's a lot of this stuff that I find pretty bad.
There was a real like a real trench of quality around there.
Yes.
Yeah, just like in the like late 90s or.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
My favorite song that I think people usually hate. Might be simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
Oh, geez.
Because I hate Christmas music, but that is such a, this is the default tone on this keyboard, fucking ship it, like that I've ever heard. It's so dorky and misguided. There's no reason to put that keyboard tone on a song.
Yeah.
And then put it on a radio. I think I take a perverse joy in that.
I can see that. Again, that is very tied with associations. I worked in a mall for many years and like never heard the keyboard on that. All that I heard was the incessant just over and over again. It just a real, like just a real insipid melody on that. Can't stand it. Can't do it.
Yeah, it's real rough. Just listen to the beginning. It's really stupid. It's exceptionally stupid.
Man, this is hard because there are a lot of bad songs, but none that come to mind because I'm not exposed to them that much anymore.
Yeah, so you don't work retail, you don't have to listen to bad music. It's kind of awesome.
Don't have to do that. Like I could throw on like a Red Hot Chili Peppers, say like, oh yeah, like that, like get on top or Around the World. I think.
Or those favorite songs that you love that people generally hate.
No, God, no. Yeah,
for Around the World, huh?
No.
I mostly don't like it, but that one verse is really good.
The one verse of Red Hot Chili Peppers Around the World that is just him mimicking, like doing a stereotypical imitation of Chinese, of the way the people from China talk.
Again, they put it on the radio.
Yeah. some real low cards there. Had to listen to that one a lot because the GameStop that I worked at was across from a Hollister. Weezer's Beverly Hills, real rough.
Oh, good lord.
Yeah.
What's something you like that people hate?
Something I like that people hate. man, this is like that also is hard. But like thinking from like the like from the 90s, there are some songs like from around like the year 2000 or whatever. Oh, here's this. I think that absolutely Story of a Girl is a pretty good bop.
Yeah, that's a good song.
Yeah.
Man, I heard a weird stripped down deconstructed cover of Hey Jealousy.
Uh-huh.
By the Gin Blossoms. And I was like, you know what? That's a good song.
Yeah.
The production doesn't help it, but like that's a bop.
Mm-hmm.
You give that a different treatment and different production. Yeah. And like a lot of times for me, a different vocal posture is the biggest thing. Like that's the thing with Story of a Girl. Like the chords and melody of that song, I think are good.
Yeah.
It's just the vocal posture.
I'll say this. Drops of Jupiter by Train. You take the lyrics off of that. That's actually a pretty good song too, I think.
I have to listen to that again. I don't know if I know that one well enough.
Yeah.
Speaking of Pretty Fly for a White Guy, a funny thing that the band has been doing. So Brian, who plays drums in the band, we were just talking, and we were talking about brunch, you know, because we live in Portland. It's a big brunch town, and how he doesn't like runny eggs.
Okay. Know?
And he was talking about how everyone's, you know, taking pictures of the runny eggs and just being like, oh, yeah, you know, look at this runny egg. And how he feels like a little kid because he has to go like, I like my egg scrambled, please. And the way he said it sounded exactly like a breakdown in an Offspring song. So when we've been practicing and stuff, one of us will just play like an Offspring riff and go, I like my egg scrambled, please. And then go,
it's keep very them separated.
Yeah. Like my egg scrambled, please.
You know what? Keep them separated is a very picky eater vibe to take.
It really is.
The cords touching the mashed potatoes.
Plate. Yeah, very much so. But that's a vocal posture thing. Like, I'm a sneering little brat. You know, yeah. I'm a little stinker and I got a new guitar. Yeah. Like, if you're going to play songs like that, don't sing like that. I don't know. I don't like it.
Here's one. Terrible song. You're a God.
What is that? What is You're a God?
You're a God and I am not, and I just wanted. It's like a late 90s.
I don't know if I know that one.
Oh gosh, who fucking did that song? You're a God. And it's a Vertical Horizon song.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
Everything you want. Is it another insult anthem?
Yes. Like it is. Okay. It is precisely the same energy. In fact, if before today you asked me if those were the same song, I would say absolutely those are the same song.
I was just about to say, like, this is something I love talking about so much that I should figure out a way to make content about it.
Jesus Christ.
And then got
man.
Sad thinking about Teenage Dirtbags.
Yeah. I'm ready for it any day.
Yeah. I gotta get Brayton some more free time because it is very, very fun to me to think about this kind of shit. It makes some people feel bad, but like, come on, again, not making, if you like Vertical Horizon and The Offspring, not making fun of you. Be more secure. Self-actualize. Jonathan says, I done goofed. I somehow thought Berserk was finished and was disappointed when I read through its entirety, only to just catch up to the current run. Do you have any unfinished stories you hope to finish? Are there any stories you waited for and were glad to see its conclusion? Venture Brothers.
Yeah, that's a good one, actually. Yeah.
Deadwood got a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Better Call Saul. Like, all those things were things I waited. You know, there was a long time, big wait. Mm-hmm. Jesse's story in Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Stories that kind of left dangling. Hard to say. I can't. None of those stick out. However, I am very conscious. I will much prefer to watch a show that has ended, than to hop on with one that is like ongoing.
Smart.
Is the thing. Yeah, I take that into account. So,
my big one is Carnival, which ended after two seasons and will never have an end. That is a bummer. That was how I got burned.
Yes.
You know, and Deadwood until they put out the movie that is pitch perfect.
Yes.
But that took like 20 years. It was ludicrous. And I'm not reading Berserk. I've been saving a reread for when it ends.
Same.
I do not want to get to that point again because I find that feeling very unsatisfying.
Let's see here. Connor says, hey fellas, That's Pete White. That's the voice that we're doing. Yes.
Yeah, we're not just doing a stereotypical effeminate voice.
No. Hey, fellas. Thanks for the great show. I just got Baldur's Gate 3. I intentionally didn't correct that, thinking maybe you were going to get it, Gary.
Oh, yeah.
That's obviously autocorrect.
Yeah.
I just got Baldur's Gate 3, and I'm looking forward to playing along with you. This is a question for Cole. I've heard you mention ambient music a couple of times now. I also really love the genre, and I'm always looking for recommendations. Are there any artists you particularly like? I'm real basic with that stuff, you know, Brian Eno, and the other albums that are in that kind of series. He didn't do all of them, but he produced a bunch of them, but just, you know, ambient 1, 2, 3, 4, are good. None of the shit is ever named, so it's also hard to do. The Aphex Twin, you know, ambient works also is good. Most of what I listen to, that is quote unquote ambient is, just very chill video game music. You know, so like the Machinarium soundtrack fits in with that. Also, Shearwater, they did a series of ambient albums over the quarantine. And those are available. Maybe they're on streaming, but it's definitely on Bandcamp. So, yeah.
Nice. And then maybe we got here Luigi at Large. Mm-hmm. Maybe this be, and then do the lightning round. Or yeah, do we got some show questions? Let's move on to show questions so we get some representation. Mm-hmm. Of that. It's always a little bit hard when we're doing oops all questions to time it out.
Yes.
Yeah. Stone Skeleton says, hey, gang, as somebody who is trying to get into doing YouTube reviews, I was wondering if you could share any insight into the note-taking process you have. On one hand, I feel like I should be able to just remember most things, but the level of thoroughness you guys bring is something to be admired. Oftentimes, I'll end up taking notes for maybe the first hour or two of a game, but fall behind and just stop taking them altogether. I imagine the answer is probably just more discipline, but just wondering if there are any tips or advice for people who look up to you guys as passionate and articulate gamesmen. Thanks for the shows. I talk about you guys a lot to my non-gamer girlfriend, and she often has no idea what I'm talking about, but she loves Baldur's Gate 3, so I'm going to try to get her into real lich hours.
Yeah, you better do it. You better do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you guys can't share a Patreon. I'm joking.
As the person who has taken the, you know, the bulk of the notes, really it's just kind of paying attention and picking out things that I will feel very bad if I do not get mention it, if I forget to include it in the outline. Usually there, oftentimes I am taking like a rough note that is like if I just pasted it and like it would be unusable by anybody else but me. But then I go back and then make it coherent, turn it into sentences or whatever. For us to look at on the outline. There's also a lot of like retroactive kind of things where like I will have made a note about something, but then I realize, oh, there was something that preceded that. So then going back and remembering where that was, so that when we bring up the thing that I wanted to make a note of, it does not come out of nowhere.
Mm.
Yeah. But it's really just a matter of always having the notes app open, not notes app. I use an app called Obsidian for taking notes, either having that on another monitor, or I literally have a stand on my, like on my recliner for my laptop to take notes while I play or watch things. It would be impractical for literally anybody else without this job. But it is there, and that's how it rolls.
I'm doing notes for real lich hours.
Mm-hmm.
This thing we're switching it up. In what I've been doing is doing the same thing in terms of making nonsensical notes, mm-hmm. but then referencing in the back for like the context and proper names of things. When I'm mm-hmm. taking notes, I just call things dog or like beach, and then I pull up a walkthrough or wiki.
Yeah,
to do stuff like that.
I do that so much when we talk about movies. Yeah. Like my raw notes are like blonde lady.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason not to.
Yeah,
you know, it's just and a lot of times a synopsis or walkthrough functions as such.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of depends on the game, but a lot of times it kind of is notes already.
Yeah.
Sometimes like it's a weird thing. Like there are things where I'm just like, I'll write something out and then I will look and be like, oh, this is already written out for me,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere else. So like there's an element of you remember things better when you take notes,
yeah.
which is worthwhile. Like I'm not discounting that in any way, mm-hmm. but also don't deny yourself the people who have already done the work ahead of you.
Yeah.
You know, you'll still have your own insights you're bringing to this thing. You know, and if they occur to you in the moment, like, make note of them for sure. But if you think that they are locked into your brain and you just need to know what happened in the mm-hmm. game you're YouTubing about, that descriptions exist.
Yeah.
You know, that quest, that quest line or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do we fall on saying the name?
I mean, we said it before.
Okay. Yeah. Cinnamon Toast Cunt says, do you tend to have a nostalgic perspective on Duck Feed's earlier periods, even when the circumstances were objectively less favorable? What were your favorite pieces of that time?
Not really. There are specific, like, positive memories mm-hmm. of things, but I don't feel nostalgic for them in, like, that achy way that I associate with nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, like, you know, I'll think back to specific, like, conventions we've gone to or panels or, like, duck streams or things like that and think fondly of them, but I don't feel like anything is over,
mm-hmm.
you know, so kind of no.
Yeah.
There are individual games and stuff. Like, there was a time where we were at a point where all of my favorite games of all time, I was going to get a chance to talk about. Yeah. In detail, like, we were on one side of me being able to talk about Deus Ex and Torment and Fallout 2
yeah.
and stuff, and that was really cool. But then I just got new favorites.
Yep.
Like, we also got to talk about Darkest Dungeon, and we're talking about Baldur's Gate 3, and, like, we talked about Disco Elysium. Like,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff still happens. I'm still living in that, is how I feel.
Yeah, that's very well put. When I think back to a lot of that, especially doing the shows alongside having a full-time job, I will question and think, oh man, how did I have the energy or where did I have the time? The answer is I was fucking destroying my body and I was a goddamn wreck.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, I don't know.
The time came from blood.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I'm not nostalgic for that.
No.
You know, bleeding for work.
Nope.
I, you know, that shit sucks and nobody should have to do it.
Nope.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah. Michael says, I love having the premium feed and public combo as I listen to probably 95% of the episodes. Occasionally there's a show or episode I don't listen to. For example, I've not yet gotten into the Venture Brothers, but when I eventually do, I'll listen to Orb from the back catalog. I have my podcast player auto download new episodes as I frequently find myself on a subway or other areas with poor cell service. So having all the podcasts already downloaded is convenient. I'm guessing each of these downloads counts as a listen in your stats. My question, should I and other listeners avoid pre-downloading all the shows if we don't listen to every one of them? I hate for my habits to pollute your statistics, especially around making decisions based on which shows perform well. It's possible that we're a statistically insignificant few who use podcast players this way, but I wanted to ask publicly so we can get your take and learn a little bit more about how listener counts affect future show and episode planning. Keep up the great work.
Listener counts have less to do with whether we decide to do a show or continue a show than how fun it is to do, you know? The stats are never going to matter enough to me that I will tell somebody to make listening to the shows less convenient for them.
Yeah. Don't change anything.
Please don't.
Yeah. The way that I conceive of it, and I don't know if this is necessarily healthy, but I think of Watch Out for Fireballs and Bonfireside Chat as moneymakers
mm-hmm.
That, like, get people in the door.
Yep.
And then everything else, I like that people listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't do it if no one listened to it, probably.
Yeah.
Like, that'd be weird. But mm-hmm. I don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I stopped looking at numbers a long time ago because it's bad for my brain,
mm-hmm.
Even when they're good.
Right.
Like, I just don't like quantifying mm-hmm. My self-worth. I don't think that is good for my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just like, these shows are going good. That's fine. Everything mm-hmm. else is just if we feel like doing it and we're getting some response and people seem to dig it.
Yeah.
That's good in a vague, non-quantifiable way.
Yeah. Listen to things the way that they are the most convenient for you is broadly the thing. The only act that I would take exception to is like distributing the shows to a bunch of people.
Yeah, please don't do that.
Please don't do that. You know, the premium stuff, I don't even know that I like take
it's
it.
Not a rational worry. Like I think about that too. There was a guy, the guy who got really mad at me because Irina's quest line
uh-huh.
bugged in Bonfireside Chat, who was, calling me fat in Twitter DMs and making up new accounts to do it on tweets once a week for months and months, like an entire autumn. Kept saying, oh, you know, I downloaded your Bonfire Side Chat and I uploaded it to file share, to Kazaa or some shit, you know, so whatever the kids are using to share files now.
Yeah.
I Napstered your shit, Ulrich. Kept doing that. And like, they were trying to do it to hurt me. I don't know if that person really exists, though. That's the audience for that. Like, I don't know if somebody doesn't like us enough, but likes our content enough to go through the work of pirating it.
Yeah.
I know there are people who don't like us, who do like our content, because they leave us angry Patreon exit reviews.
Yes.
Or they yell at us. And I know that there are people who don't like us enough, but they just quit. Like they just stop listening to it, or they stay here and begrudgingly stay trapped in us and just deal with our bullshit for eternity.
To which I would say, go genie, you're free.
Or die angry. Like either way works for me. But I don't know necessarily that if you were to take our back catalog and upload it, it's not going to get downloads like, you know, a season of a TV show. Is at the same time, though, it just it feels kind of bad. And it's, if that person's out there, I don't want to take money for myself and also from people who like, I don't want to take money from Will.
Right.
You know, I don't want to take money from other people who derive part of their living, you know, from this. Like that's that feels shitty.
You know? It just there's something about distributing it that that feels way worse than somebody who for financial needs finds a way around, or even finds a way around the paywall, right? Like if we had a way to offer discounted or free memberships to people, we would do it. It's just ludicrous. Patreon doesn't.
Like my wife patronizes us because she likes listening to the show. It's very sweet, but it's just me taking money from my own account and then giving myself back a third of it. Basically, like it's really dumb. It's because the Patreon doesn't have like a coupon system or something like that. And I really wish they would, because that would be great.
It would.
You know, that'd be a cool like thing to give out for Duckstream donations, you know, from time to time. Like that'd be a really useful thing. Because my working theory has always been the people who support us are not doing it just because they like listening to the stuff. They want to support.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I support the Patreons I support. Like I'm a member of like 20 different Patreons. That is because I want those faucets to keep going. It has very little to do with an exchange of money for goods. Personally.
So do what's most convenient. It doesn't bother us. We're just happier here.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Shelby, lightning round.
Let's lighten it up. Lightning crashes.
It does. Placentas dropping like stars. I've seen placentas drop off the Rings of Orion.
Patrick writes, what are y'all's favorite games to play during the holiday season?
I usually treat myself to a big AAA thing we're not covering for work during the holiday season. Last year it was Midnight Suns. This year it's going to be Spider-Man 2.
Cool.
I also have a replay of Alpha Protocol in me that I'm going to try to make time for.
Oh, nice. I've
been feeling the itch.
Long time ago used to be console RPGs, you know, go back to something nostalgic. No time for that really now. However, past couple of years, like 2 years ago, I did Life is Strange 2, which is really good. Last year, I did Life is Strange True Colors. I might be looking for a similar narrative heavy thing. Another adventure game to kind of fill in there. Nice. That's my answer.
Eric says, what's the price point on Patreon so we can get a limited run podcast of every episode of Rubik the Amazing Cube? Your delight was infectious. It's secret. It's the same as the hidden Patreon amount that makes us cancel Guppy. That we've been dangling in front of you for years. It's a secret. You'll know when we get to it.
Because it'll happen.
It'll happen. I have that song is in my regular rotation. The ending and beginning credits of Rubik the Amazing Cube that has maintained, again, Adaptation Decay, a show that I think is one of our better shows, like consistently a delight, and is for patrons.
Yes.
Even if you just bump up to $10 and listen to them and then bump back down, I think it's worth it.
Those are good
episodes.
Do it.
Yeah.
Robert writes, I haven't really thought about this in a while, but it came up in an episode I listened to recently. Has J.G. Greer ever mentioned receiving any confusing and or annoying emails? In case you forgot, that's the default mail address Gary recites whenever he doesn't want anybody to correct him.
if so, he has not mentioned it.
Uh-huh.
So that is that's something Will and I do as well. Have you, Cole? Because Will will use you a lot.
No.
And stuff like that. Will you get like a random?
No. Occasionally, I'll get like a tweet about something, but there is the omerta. I think people know not to tell me what goes on in regards to me on Guppy.
That's great.
Yeah,
I love that. People keep it up. Yeah, never change. Wade says, "Hi, Gary, I notice you often use the word vorpal, which I recognize from the Jabberwocky, but always interpret it as a nonsense word. There are definitions online, but I just wonder what you meant when you say it. Thanks." My reference is less literary than the Jabberwocky.
Yeah.
Even I'm familiar with the Jabberwocky and stuff, but I'm using D&D. The vorpal sword is a sword that kills if you get a critical hit. The idea of like a weapon that is automatically deadly.
Yes, specifically chops off the head.
Yes.
If you get a critical hit, otherwise it's just a +5 weapon.
Still good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so think of just a weapon that or death touch in magic or something.
Yeah,
like something that is fatal.
It's our particular way of calling something a deal breaker is really just what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, we gotta do another dictionary.
Holland writes, not a question as much as a PSA, because I didn't hear it mentioned in the RE4 remake episode. If you read the backs of the stone pillars near the end of the game, it is revealed that they canonically gave Sadler the first name Adam. That's right. Adam Sadler. It's good to know that the RE team has so many Billy Madison fans in its ranks. Stop looking at me, Leon.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
Hi, my name's Adam. I own a bug that can destroy the world.
that's incredible. I did not notice that. That is why we didn't mention it, or we would have camped out on it for days.
Oh, yeah.
We'd still be doing it. That's incredible.
Oh,
Drew on Arrival says, happy birthday, Cole.
And I'll thank you. Enjoy.
Okay, we're recording this the day after your birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Cole. Any cool fictional characters that share your birthday?
It's not a cool one, but I know that for some reason this bit of trivia sticks in my head from reading the Final Fantasy VII manual. I share a birthday with Yuffie.
Okay.
Yeah, with Yuffie Kisaragi. So my birthday is shared with both Yuffie and Joe Biden.
My birthday is shared with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, well, fuck me.
I laugh at you because you're the same. You laugh because I'm That it's I'm amazed that question came out and you just had a ready answer for it. I don't know any fictional characters' birthdays.
Nope.
like is that something people have common?
Yeah.
Cachet on.
I know the date of Bob and Linda Belcher's anniversary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because it was a plot point.
Yeah.
You know, it popped up. I just found out. I just searched September 8th birthdays.
Uh-huh.
That's where I saw Bernie Sanders. Also, Neko Case. That's great.
Cool.
But somebody without additional information, I share a birthday with somebody named Gary Speed. Who's Gary Speed?
Wait a minute, Gary. You don't know about Gary
Welsh
Speed?
A Welsh professional. He's a football player. Footballer.
Okay.
No, I didn't know about Gary Speed.
No, I was gonna say he was your Tyler Durden. He's out when you're awake. It's really totally lively at parties.
Like significantly more lively than I am, as opposed to Gary Slow, aka Butterfield. Gary Speed. Shit, dude. Yeah. Yeah, it shares a birthday. Huh. Happy birthday, Speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only reason I know that is just memories of, I don't know, taking the Final Fantasy VII manual to read in the backseat of a car and just being like, huh, I share a birthday with this person. Weird.
It's probably an age thing where I wonder if the question answer asker is around the same age, because when I had that time to like go deep on manuals like that, that kind of information wasn't included. You know, it was before my JRPG phase.
It was weird to see birthdays included. That like the Final Fantasy VII manual was also the first manual that I read that included blood types, which I thought was weird before I knew about the blood type personality thing, which may be eugenicsy. Well, no, it's definitely eugenicsy.
But, I'm not crazy about the blood type personality thing.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, it seems bad. I don't want to get yelled at, but I don't like it. That's going to be it for those questions.
Lively is what that has been.
Lively. We're going to get in and we're going to read responses to this month's games.
We are. We're going to get started with Sayonara Wild Hearts with Robin, who writes and saying, well, I had a great time with this game. I really wish that it hadn't shown me that a scoring system was active during the first run. It instantly flagged me that I might be missing content or an ending if I wasn't getting the high score. I really wish the game had just played out as a pass-fail journey on the first run-through and then let you go back to score chase. Let me soak in the game as an album/movie and then re-embrace it in the form of a game as a game. But curious to hear your thoughts on the matter if this doesn't come up in the episode. That's a very good idea.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. The game is so profoundly unconcerned with your score and wants you to see the end of it.
It's
already an optional and vestigial thing. I wonder if that occurred to the devs and they rejected it, or if they felt like they had to have a score, you know, because they were kind of doing a thing that was going to get accusations of slightness kind of no matter what.
And so much of what they are doing is reinterpretations of and sampling of like old video game. It's very concerned with being a video game that a score might be part of that.
But I like that idea a lot too. It didn't bug me because I'm not a score chaser.
Yeah.
You know, but I could see, I think that Robin's right. Andrew C says, at one point in the episode, both of you wondered if this game might be effective for somebody who doesn't regularly play games. My answer is absolutely. My best friend was visiting me after having gone through a breakup. She hasn't ever owned a video game console, but got totally sucked in by this game and the catharsis it offered. And even though she's deaf, the amazing use of visuals, rhythm, and haptics meant she hugely enjoyed it as a musical experience that was accessible for her. After she was done, she asked me if there are any more games like it. My answer, unfortunately, not really. But I do hope there are many more to come. That's great.
Yeah, that is a really cool story.
Very cool. I love, you know, the go back to that story of the person who was blind playing Oddworld. You know, based on the sounds, like I love that. I love it when a game has such strong multi-sensory components that it kind of like it. A lot of times it's not intentional. Like this isn't an accessibility issue, but they fall backwards into greater accessibility than a lot of games get on purpose.
The closest thing I could think to make a recommendation, like, you know, synesthetic experience, probably be like Rez, honestly. Yeah.
Depending on how much of the emotional core of this.
Yeah, that's what that's key also to it, the, though, thing.
Is the thing. Because Rez is
cyber world. Yeah.
Yeah. It's heartless. It's a realm.
Andrew T says, women will literally become a masked hero tasked with saving an alternate universe governed by tarot cards, where she'll have to process a breakup by fighting incarnations of the flaws she has projected onto others in a pop musical Neon Fantasia viewed through the historical lens of video games before discovering she must accept those flawed aspects in herself and practice both self-love and universal love to properly move on instead of going to therapy. Parentheses complimentary.
Yeah. True.
Yep.
Yeah. This game getting through my aversion to tarot did a good work. This and Isaac
holding,
handshaking meme
had it. So I just, you know, seeing the titles, I see what goes out. I see what you guys are covering on Isaac, and just seeing that you're in the valley of the tarot card.
It's all tarot.
Yeah. Poor Gary.
For a little while, Will was doing like a quote unquote bit where he talked about what the tarot card symbolized and then realized that was comedy death. Like that's not a bit.
Yeah.
It's just saying things.
Okay.
So he stopped. I didn't have to make fun of him into stopping. He just stopped. And I was just, you know, I was fine. Like, let's see where this goes. But we don't really talk about the little secret. We don't really talk about Isaac that much.
No.
On there. Dilly Bones says, Sayonara Wild Hearts is my ideal snack of a game. I'm generally not very into rhythm games. I lack rhythm. But having low stakes, beautifully animated album experience was exactly what I didn't know I wanted. It's a game-o type I would love to see more experimentation with. I remember vividly being 11 years old and putting my brother's CD copy of the Deftones' White Pony into our Bondi Blue iMac and being blown away that you could play a reskinned Pac-Man that played a MIDI version of Elite. I would sit there for hours, not even playing the actual version of the song, being transported to the baby gamer nu metal paradise of the best 2001 Flash has to offer. As they say, video games have come a long way since Pac-Man. I'm glad they ended up with Sayonara Wild Hearts. Here's hoping more artists and devs collaborate on these kinds of curated virtual albums. Also, I found out that I'm kind of a sicko for whom Queen Latifah shouting, "Bronze rank!" unlocked something. glad you boys enjoyed the breezy delight of Sayonara Wild Hearts. Hope you cover more inventive snacks like this in the future. Me too.
I hope for there to be more.
Yeah.
Okay. Me too. But I kind of expected more pushback about stuff being short.
Okay.
You know, or of that episode being short.
Okay.
Because that might be our shortest episode that's non
NES.
For a bundle or something.
Yeah.
Not an NES and not for like a bundle or something. Mm-hmm. And I kind of expected people to be angry about it, but it seems like people understood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great.
Yeah.
You know, because I like having a varied part of it is obviously a work concern. Mm-hmm. You know, like we did that the same reason we did The Order, because we were doing Mass Effect and GTA 5, like two long games mm-hmm. right next to each other. But I also have a varied, like, that's what I like to play.
Yeah.
You know, I like breaking up my really huge games and my small games. And I would love to do more things that are like interesting, but maybe a little slight,
mm-hmm.
you know, if they're interesting.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I would like to know if there are more things like this. This one stuck out because the big publisher, and you know, made a splash for its obvious quality or whatever. I don't know. See the Abject Suffering episode about the Radiohead Kid A Amnesia exhibition. This is cool. Like, it's cool. Like, music, video game crossover stuff is good.
It's super good. It's also
maybe not
thing,
the Deftones Pac-Man, but generally.
Yeah, I mean, that's not for me. A lot of that stuff too ends up landing on Abject Suffering.
Yes.
Like, there's no reason we couldn't do a WAF on the Looker.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that would have been great. I would have loved, we should have done it immediately after The Witness, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But like, it's just a counterpoint. But like that, there's no, you know, that could have been a full episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just ended up sticking them there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God, The Looker is so good.
God, I love The Looker. It's it's one of my favorite jokes. Full stop, any medium. Like.
Oh, gosh. That was you, so this will be me. Moving on to Grand Theft Auto 5 questions, Harry says, "Hi guys, forgive me for saying what I am sure 100 other dudes or gals have pointed out, but bullet time for driving was in the Midnight Club games.
Oh.
I only add my voice to an assumed chorus to say how much I love the Midnight series. Coming to them from Need for Speed, had that invisible walls limiting your path. I loved the freedom that Midnight Club gave you. If you missed a turn, you would have to catch the next one, making up time by driving through an office building or plunging off of an overpass. Also loved the scramble races where checkpoints would be done in any order. From what I understand, the driving physics engine was wrapped into GTA and is part of the reason why a follow-up has never been made past the less than perfect Midnight Club Los Angeles." You are one of two people who wrote in to tell mm-hmm. us about Midnight Club. That is specifically in the email. Maybe other people said stuff in other places. But that is good to know that's where that comes from. And it's even within the company.
As a, you know, as we talked about in Burnout Paradise, like, I'm not a racing game guy. I'm mm-hmm. shitty at them. That's really cool. That sounds interesting to me. I just assumed Midnight Club games were racing games.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have a good handle on the depth of the genre.
Yes.
So good to know. Michael says, and oh shit, it's the Michael from GTA 5. we're fucked. probably not. Michael says, the usual caveat about recommendations being poison, but listening to the GTA 5 episode, you guys might like Cyberpunk 2077. From the sounds of it, it has a lot of the parts you liked about GTA 5. There are a couple of really good involved heists with immersive sim touches. The city is fun to drive around in and see the sights. The new DLC improves many mechanical aspects of the game, and it even has Idris Elba in it. Best of all, Cyberpunk doesn't have nearly as much hateful writing. The narrative is still a pretty dumb open world plot, but there's some believable emotion and humanity at times. Heartily recommended. Keep up the great work, folks. I really want to play that. That's on my list. Yeah. It's in the very short list of things that, like, it would be my winter break game if I wasn't sure we'd cover it for the show.
Yeah.
At some point, now that winter RPG month is changing forms. Mm-hmm. A little bit with real itch hours, there's no reason why we can't do a New Vegas and do that during the year at some point.
Yeah,
you know, just like do a two-parter, like we did GTA 5 as a two-parter. Mm-hmm. And that would ordinarily be a month long thing, and it turned out the episodes weren't a million years long. Mm-hmm. You know, the counterpoint to that wanting to do more Sayonara Wild Hearts length games, mm-hmm, is also wanting to be able to find room for something like this more than once a year.
Yes. Yeah,
you know, so like there's no guarantees, it's not on the schedule.
Yeah.
But I would love a chance to play that.
Programming this show has consistently been one of the best, like most enjoyable challenges we've had over the years. You know, like it is a puzzle. It is a puzzle to solve, but like it's generally, I don't know. It's
satisfying. There's feedback. There's immediate feedback.
Yeah.
You know, like when we fuck up, when we make a mistake or we do something that is misguided, like we know it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're like, well, shit, we did these two things that are exactly the same next to each other.
Yeah.
You know, and we just get immediate feedback. It's really good. Mm-hmm. But loosening that schedule, you know, with my console RPG wanting to not do standard ones of those anymore and adding real lich hours, mm-hmm, some of that structure, I would like to see dissolve a little bit. You know, with the exception of Horror Month, which will be our cornerstone and will never.
Here's the thing. There will always at least be Horror Month.
Yes.
You know, time was in the past, we would have a spring horror game too.
Yeah. So. And I'm happy to bring that back. Like, fuck it, man. Chaos mode. Like, let's do what makes good shows and is interesting stuff to talk about. Promise me you'll never do anything that's a rule.
Yep.
Is it true that there's no such thing as a rule? Like,
being in trouble is a fake idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Biff Whiff is on Blue Sky. Welcome, Biff Whiff.
Hi, Biff.
I love him.
Yeah.
What does Nina say?
Yes. Nina says, the weird thing about Grand Theft Auto V's, quote, satire is that it is so on the nose, unsubtle, and self-congratulatory that it almost loops around to being funny for those exact reasons. Like nearly every, quote, joke on the radio has the wit of an edgelord 14-year-old boy's forum signature, but the voice actors commit to them so hard. Like they're aware of how stupid it is and figure they may as well go full camp. That I just have to chuckle. It reminded me of the superliminal joke from The Simpsons. Hey, you, join the Navy. Hey, you, all women are whores. Don't clip that. Don't clip that. That's the level we're operating
just
on.
Just because I want to provide an alternative. Clip that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, do as you will. There are no, promise me you won't do anything that's a rule. Including Cole telling you not to clip his slurs.
Jeez.
Please don't clip my slurs.
Jesus. Don't get me wrong. I'm not giving Rockstar any credit. I'm about 80% sure my brain just came up with an emergency defense mechanism to protect itself from an aneurysm. I sincerely hope the next game does a lot better on the satire front, especially when it comes to picking its targets. But this ended up being how I processed Grand Theft Auto V's humor so that I could enjoy the rest of this sprawling, super fun game.
Yeah, you gotta have something.
Yeah.
If you're gonna compartmentalize. Like for me, I started ignoring anything that wasn't coming out of like a character's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all the advertising and signage and stuff just became, you know, scene missing.
Mm-hmm.
Like became stock footage of feeding a baby goat.
Yeah.
And that's how I got through that. Like I had to ignore it.
Yeah.
You gotta do something. Yeah.
Just like life without being able to forget would be hell.
Yeah.
Like if you never forgot anything, life without just a little bit of dissociation would be hell. So
if you could never ignore anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just really rough. And like we had to check it out a little bit because we had to talk about it, you know, which was fine. But I wasn't going to go deep.
No,
you know, like I'd rather die than like watch all the movies in that game.
Not for me.
Know? Just like I you know, people who were like, man, I can't believe Grand Theft Auto 4 comes with a free set by Ricky Gervais.
You know, and like, people bought it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Mitchell says, I'm not sure if you guys will get into it, but I want to share my short experience with GTA Online. I know GTA Online is a shark card / microtransaction infested hellscape shark card. Shark card. I'm not sure what that means. A shark card / microtransaction infested hellscape used primarily to make short clips of Marvel characters running obstacle courses. But for a very brief moment of time, it seemed like it could actually be fun. A bunch of my friends and I made time to try out a few of the online modes. During a team deathmatch variant, we were running around a map that had a car on it. At the beginning, we all treated it as a prop like you would in a Call of Duty game, something to hide behind and not much else. After that car exploded, I thought, I wonder if I can drive that thing. So the next round, I beelined directly to the car, hopped in, and waited. A short moment later, my buddy rounded the corner, and I gunned him pinning him to the wall. This caused his character to perform the painfully long fall down and get up ragdoll animation, long enough for me to back up and pin him again. This sequence played out 5 or 6 times before his character finally died. Imagine if that happened during 1 minute in Breaking Bad. While I laughed maniacally at the absurd situation, I could hear the enthusiasm for the game drain from my buddy's voice.
That's also very funny.
That's great. I then drove around the corner and promptly got blown up by a rocket. Altogether, it was actually a pretty enjoyable gaming session. For me, at least. Due to the general nature of GTA Online, the availability of better multiplayer games, or perhaps in part due to the troll car incident, we never really touched the online portion of the game again. Despite the crapulence that GTA Online became, that moment of repeatedly backing into my buddy's character will remain one of my favorite gaming moments.
That's very fun.
That's great.
I like that a lot. That is actually the best. Like, little things like that are actually the best that a multiplayer game can be.
Yeah.
So
it's the best thing I can think of for GTA Online.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't have a lot of, you know, you hear about like people being doing weird shit about that. But yeah, that's that surpasses my expectations.
Yeah. Shark card. So this, we get more responses than we actually include on the air. Sorry if we cut everybody's. The other person who wrote in with their Grand Theft Auto Online experience also mentioned shark card. To look it up
to give credit here.
Apparently the shark cards are what they call like buying in-game currency. So when you go like to the Steam store, like they've got different levels of cards named after different sharks that confer different amounts of in-game currency.
It's not a general like microtransaction whale thing.
No,
that's what I assumed.
No. Yeah.
No, this is the GTA specifically, you buy shark cards.
Yes.
I love the idea of explaining games to people who do words, like who just do normal English and like understand what things mean. You know, like I didn't have enough digicreds for my shark cards.
That's right, you know? Mr. Sherman. It stinks.
It all stinks.
And we got a last one here from Precisely Jay, who has a little bit of insight for us. This is a long one, but I figured it was worth including. Hey guys, love hearing your thoughts about Grand Theft Auto 5. And while I don't have a lot of playtime on the game myself, I worked closely with people who worked on it and have some thoughts based on that experience. All of this is speculation, of course. I'm definitely not saying this is 100% correct, nor do I think this was intentional by them, but I think they did it without realizing. With as many people who worked on their games, the core of the narratives used to mostly come out of the founders of Rockstar. They've mostly moved on since Red Dead Redemption 2. These are dudes who have embodied the GTA / Rockstar lifestyle for decades and have taken that attitude from being a small, scrappy company freaking out the normies in the 90s to literally being one of the most profitable entertainment companies in history. So my hypothesis is that Grand Theft Auto 5 and Red Dead Redemption 2, but from a different frame of mind, is just an exploration of the midlife crises of extremely rich white dudes who used to be rebels and now are part of the system and don't know how to handle it or the world they currently live in. That's why we get some middle-aged family man who used to be hot shit as the core character of a game whose main demographic is arguably well under his age, with Trevor and Franklin being embodiments of both the past and future, as well as two big archetypes that I think live within the same author: the chaos monster and the young dude just trying to do his best with the system that failed him. I see a take on Grand Theft Auto 5 that is about the anger of being in a world that has moved on from you when you legitimately thought they were winning at life, but they suddenly feel left in middle age and stuck in unhappiness. American Beauty by way of Fast and Furious. You can see it in Red Dead Redemption 2 as well, I think. If you think of the cast as being this same person from the perspective of someone as outside of them, and since it was headed by a different person in the core Rockstar group than Grand Theft Auto 5, I do think that's a possible take. Dutch, Micah, and John could realistically be Michael, Trevor, and Franklin if you are looking at them from the outside. If you are looking at them from the outside themselves. Red Dead Redemption 2 is also partially about not knowing what to do in a world that is moving on from you when you used to be a rebel, but there's this person who you love who keeps driving you to continue doing the things that you used to do, even though they aren't working anymore, and you are trying to figure out what to do with this person before he ends up getting you and everyone you work with killed. Am I saying these two stories boil down to essentially analogies of the heads of Rockstar and their relationships to both each other and to the company they've built over decades? I think that take is there if you look for it. Could I also be saying that based on the biases I built through my own personal experiences with people who also probably have their own personal biases? Absolutely. But that's art analysis, baby. Here's one more. Here's one crazy, more solid fact, though. I have on good authority that a lot of the sports mini games, golf, etc., were built in the last few weeks of development by devs already working 80 plus hours a week on the regular. So didn't get a lot of time to be tested for bugs or fun. They crammed those suckers in at the finish line. That is absolutely not worth 80 plus hour weeks.
No,
it's not worth it. the tennis mini game in this, not worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was horrible or anything either, but it's not worth anyone hurting themselves. I also, the read of this as a midlife crisis directly from the people at Rockstar makes me worry about them having body dysmorphia.
A little bit.
They made a character with an average body type who everyone calls fat constantly. Yeah, it's a Rockstar, guys. You're probably not fat. It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just getting older. It's okay. Your body changes and it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to be buff as an old guy. Like, that makes everyone uncomfortable.
A little bit embarrassing, yeah.
Yeah, like, if you ever go to the beach and there's, like, an old guy who's, like, very muscular, everyone is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Nobody likes it.
Yeah, notice how they can split a crowd.
Yeah, exactly. Aim for average. Mm-hmm. Like Michael. Yeah, that's a good, there's a lot of good insight there.
Yeah.
I do think that, like, that could definitely be the case. And one of the things I like about that response is it's not doing the explanation means justification.
Yeah, yeah.
That people can sometimes do. Mm-hmm. You know, when they're like, oh, this is just the explanation, therefore it is good.
Yeah.
Like, that could be what happened. They still made this sloppy, ridiculous narrative with all of this gross bigotry in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that could have been the impetus behind it. Like, that is good psychoanalysis. But at the end of the day, there's the plate.
Yeah, there's a plate, but also, like, maybe some of that trying to process the midlife crisis or whatever, you know, did end up giving us the good thing about this, which is bits. Trevor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
but also process harder.
Yeah.
And you know, also men would rather make GTA 5 than go to therapy. Like, you know, go to therapy. Or go to a better therapist. I feel like they maybe did go to a therapist, but the guy really sucked, so they decided to assassinate him.
Built him into the game. Yeah. Yeah,
figuratively and literally in the game. So
just come to accept the passage of time and the fact that we all have different seasons.
Yeah, we're all gonna die.
Yep.
Moving on to responses to the Order 1886, Naveen says, the Order is such an odd duck of a game. Coming at the tail end of the boom of cover-based shooters aping Gears of War, it felt like Sony's SOP to jump.
SOP? Yeah, Sony's SOP to all the Xbox 360.
What's a SOP?
A SOP, that's a way of saying, like, just like throwing it out like slop for the pigs. That's a SOP for like, oh, this was them just like throwing it out to people.
I've only heard SOP as a verb.
Yes.
Leave all this in, because this might educate somebody.
Sopping is an adjective.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought SOP would be like you sop something up. You up slop. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say slop, because it's going to make the sentence feel better to me.
Okay.
It felt like Sony slop to all the Xbox 360 refugees, making the jump to PlayStation 4 after Microsoft's famous implosion going into that generation. And as one of those shooters, it's actually quite good. The game still looks outstanding today technically, and the steampunk Victorian era was clearly highly developed. The gunplay's fun, the arsenal of weapons provides a varied experience through its runtime, but I can't help feeling off about its politics. The game glorifies the British Empire at its height, a time of brutal subjugation of a quarter of the world's populace. By making the Knights of the Round Table the effectively immortal enforcers of this regime, it adds a Call of Duty style glorification to an empire that would make the current American one seem tame by comparison. The game clumsily tries to address this with a subplot surrounding Lakshmi and the United India Company, but it's all set dressing for more supernatural hijinks. Still, it's hard for me to picture Galahad and the company rounding up slaves in East Africa or suppressing.
Still, it's not hard.
It's also just. Still it's not hard.
Still
it's not hard for me. Sorry. Still it's not hard for me to picture Galahad and the company rounding up slaves in East Africa or suppressing the Sepoy Rebellion. For all its mechanical and artistic mastery, it just feels rotten to its core.
That is also something I think that we are left with by the fact that this is an orphaned franchise. Like the revelation that the Order is being manipulated by literal vampires who are exporting, you know, monsters to ravage populations elsewhere, like was definitely going to be like addressed. So we get like the first half of a story about somebody who wholeheartedly believes in a purpose and then finds out, oh, I've been played and everything I was doing was bad. And then goes around. So like to that extent, it feels like they were fainting toward a turn. They probably should have, when Galahad joined the rebellion, or started being sympathetic to it, have him reckon with the fact that we opened the game with him literally hunting and gunning down escaped mental patients.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was going to say too. Like I kind of feel kind of the opposite in a lot of ways. Yeah. To this, like, I think that the way the story trajectory was going was probably towards something politically okay.
Yeah,
like him reckoning towards it, him working against it, and deconstructing that stuff.
Yeah,
it was set dressing for supernatural hijinks.
Yeah,
you know, and I, you know, guilty, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but and then I also just think the gunplay was pretty uninspired, even for the time.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine. Like, I officially have a soft spot for the Order, kinda.
Yeah.
I'll never play it again. I'll probably never think about it again.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't hate it. But I feel like politically, it probably, if it was a full story, would have ended up somewhere not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah.
Like, not good, but it wouldn't have been like an oorah, go colonialism.
Yeah.
Call of Duty thing.
It's one of those things where you don't want to make an argument from the point of be glad you got what you got.
Yeah,
I was a little bit surprised given the setting that they acknowledged colonialism in India and made one of the most sympathetic and right characters in it. In the story, somebody from there, you know, mm-hmm. with a role in an uprising, you know, thus I think endorsing an uprising against colonialism. Could have been better. We don't have to settle for it, but like I was genuinely surprised that they even, you know, worked it in, because so many Victorian stuff in the steampunk milieu or whatever just kind of elides that.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
Yeah. Francis writes, hey guys, I didn't buy The Order on release because I heard it was short and in the Sony Prestige bucket. The story seemed interesting, but a 5-hour Gears of War-like that people didn't seem too hot on was low on my list. After picking it up much cheaper a year ago, I played through it in about 1.5 sittings and never thought about it again. The game's short runtime is not necessarily a problem. I often find a game loses momentum about 2 main objectives before the end anyway, but the ratio of walk and talks and instant fail states to the rather few actual stealth and shooting boxes to play in was not good IMO. On top of that, the story shares too many elements with games like Haze. You slaughter people, then you change sides and slaughter a bunch more with little reckoning, and only touches ever so lightly on the interesting world of immortal soldiers, corrupted nobles, and colonialism, with the added wrinkle of supernatural beasts acting slightly worse towards the natives than the humans. So let me see here. Sorry. When the game ended, with a lot of points unresolved and only half the story told, I found myself thinking that the excellent third-person cover shooting in the alleys early in the game was the part that they should have leaned on. Even though you were a fast super cop killing people with genuine grievances. Vampire and Gears both did their respective bits, their respective parts better and offered a fuller package for the investment. I don't subscribe to dollars to hours thinking. I don't think bloated collectathons with nice graphics and a glut of open world icons are automatically better. But it does strike me that the same number of man hours, plastic, and other finite resources went into making this product, putting it on a disc in a box and selling it to me, than other things I can enjoy for a much longer and go back to over and over. It smacks of a project with ambitious goals that had to be cut back severely when it became apparent that those goals were not achievable and it doesn't stand on its own.
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a weird thing where I don't think that adding any of those things would make this better.
No.
You know, and I know that Francis isn't saying that either. Mm-hmm. It's a thing where what this told me was not anything about dollars to hour ratios or anything. It's more like your game needs more than one mechanic.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't need unneedful, like, added crafting bloat, but you should have some ideas. Yep. In there, you just got to have some ideas, you know, and there's not an idea to the gameplay of this.
No,
you know, the other thing too that I was thinking about this, because they mentioned Haze. I hadn't thought about Haze in a long time.
God, nobody's thought about Haze.
I never played Haze. Uh-huh. Part of my soft spot for this probably comes from the fact that I didn't play any games like this.
Oh shit, that's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, I just wasn't sick of this. This didn't feel generic to me. It felt a little bit refreshingly straightforward.
You didn't have the antibodies. Yeah.
Yeah, for that, I was like, okay, that's fine, you know? And again, I mentioned this during the episode. I just finished up Mass Effect. The shooting doesn't feel worse than Mass Effect. Mass Effect came way before
Mass Effect is, I mean, the first one is dog shit shooting.
Yeah. I find that game to be mechanically very troubling. Yeah. I'm going to dissect it on a table over those episodes in a way, you know, there are things to like about it. 100%. Yep. But like, mechanically, it's got so many problems. Mm-hmm. They end up, our accidental theme autumn continues, because comparing those two, this is a game that doesn't do enough. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not enough ideas. There's one thing it does it okay. Mm-hmm. You know, what I'm hearing from people is that pretty well for the time, standards of the time, and then decides to do nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, Mass Effect has a similar thing.
Yeah.
It decides to do very little else. Mm-hmm. You know, it adds a couple more things, but they are as vapid as it can get. It's cataloging planets, you know, shit like that. So I lost my train of thought somewhere there. I'm podcasting for a long time on very
Yeah. Sleep. If you can't, I'm realizing that I might also be a little bit poo brained because of how mush mouth I've been with some of these responses.
It's been a long dispatch.
Yeah.
It's okay. But yeah, I'm surprised that the responses were a little bit kinder to The Order than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. Still happy we did it. I'm going to put out a call to action for people. No guarantees of us doing this or anything, but hit me up on Blue Sky if you'd like. What are other games that have like a one sentence narrative about them?
Yeah.
you know, similar to this and Crisis.
Yeah.
Where like there's just one thing people know about them, but there's actually something there. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily going to inflict those on you, Cole, or mm-hmm. promise they're going to show up on the show. I just think it's an interesting thing that happens in games.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I just said like one word or one sentence, one couplet.
What are games that got dismissed?
Yeah. Like narratives or myths. Yeah.
Yes. You know, games that were dismissed with a one sentence thing. Mm-hmm. Like someday we're going to do Redfall. And I'm really looking forward to that because that's gotten more playable, is my understanding. It's changed a lot.
We're going to do Redfall is one of the bleakest things you've ever fucking said to me.
Oh, no way. Really? Yeah. Did you play Redfall or are you just going in for the myth?
No, it was Game Pass.
I hate that Game Pass.
I fired it up and I was like, ugh. I didn't even play enough of it to like rate talking about it on the level.
My understanding is a lot of that has changed a bunch. So it's a little bit, not a full redemption.
The bones are fucking rotten, dude.
We gotta know what the bones though. Like we gotta talk about them bones. Like nobody talked about that game other than just like glitchy.
No.
You know, like it, like janky. That's literally the only word I heard.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I listened to like Waypoint, talk about it.
Yeah.
But like I heard more about it.
I remember Waypoint guys talking about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just the example I pulled out of my. Someday we're gonna do every Arcane game. The show goes on long enough. It's the best case scenario, dude. It's not a bleak thing. It's a good thing. It means we're doing this job for a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. But like, shit, man, we gotta do young. We gotta do Youngblood before we.
We gotta do Youngblood, and it's gonna be rough. I have the Youngblood, but I think it would be interesting to dig into why it doesn't work.
Yeah, okay.
You know, even if we end up doing Redfall, and it still sucks with the mm-hmm. improvements. I would love to dig into why it sucks.
Okay.
All which right. is kind of what happened with both Crisis and this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the idea of these things that have the one word apocryphal description, mm-hmm. it's unlikely we're going to have redemptions in there and should stop looking for them mm-hmm. and instead just be like, what is the full story of why this is bad? Let's give it the respect that a piece of art deserves, regardless of whether it's bad.
But also an incredibly long experience designed for co-op with fucking Diablo loot.
Jesus, is it incredibly long? Like I how long is Redfall?
Yeah.
I assumed it was short because people told me it was. About 12 hours in length.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so at least there's that. Sorry. I got fucking chills up my spine when you said that.
Surprised. Yeah, I had no idea you had such strong feelings.
Yeah.
My pick for next month is Redfall. This transitions us perfectly into that.
I know.
I'm joking.
Okay, all right.
So that does transition us though. That is the segue I was trying to make.
Yes.
Calm down, Cole.
Sorry. It's
very traumatized from that.
Don't threaten me with a bad time.
I'm gonna send out just an unmarked letter to your house that just says Redfall. And see if you call, like, fucking log on to Nextdoor.
Jesus. Those were November's games. We've got December's games coming up, which are going to be Mass Effect. We got a two-parter on that. And Slayers X Terminal Aftermath, Vengeance of the Slayers, the boomer shooter as character study set in the Hypnospace Outlaw universe. That's going to be our premium episode for that month. If you have thoughts about those games, the deadline is December the 15th to write in at duckfeed.tv/contact. Gonna remind people we can't feature every response that comes in. And also included some longer ones this time just because there was content in them. Generally we do like to see it at like a couple of paragraphs a piece.
Yes,
as a guideline. What are we doing in January?
In January we're doing this is a cool pick.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing The Case of the Golden Idol.
Love that.
That's a cool pick. Looking forward to playing it. Oberdin, like mm-hmm. is my understanding.
Yes.
Very excited about that. Then we have a Patreon demand from Jack. We're doing Darkest Dungeon 2.
We are.
Yeah. I was looking at the new updates on that and realized that between early access and the thing, I've already have 100 hours in that game. So
cool.
Happy to Sherpa.
The more you play, the less I have to.
It's a big roguelike, you know. Yes. I love that game. I think it'll be a fun episode.
Mm-hmm.
I think it opens up a lot of very interesting discussion mm-hmm. in terms of like a sequel, you know, perfect at being the enemy of the good.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of thing. Like they did something very different with it. And I don't like it as much as Darkest Dungeon 1 either. But like, come on. It's still real cool. And then our premium episode for that month, and we talked about this a little bit, Bonfireside Chat, Souls-likes, things that are not Elden Ring, are going to move into regular rotation, not once a month or anything, but just move into regular rotation. Our premium episode for January is Blasphemous 2.
Yeah.
A game that was real high up on the list, possibly what we were going to cover on Bonfireside Chat. I've wanted an excuse to play it very much.
Same.
Yeah. As you're listening to this, currently on sale on the Nintendo Switch. I want to say it will still be on sale.
Possibly. It depends. But, you know, it'll go on sale around Christmas time, probably, too. So,
yeah. I am super fucking psyched.
Me
Really, really liked Blasphemous 1. Really looking forward to seeing how they iterate on those story ideas and gameplay ideas.
Yeah, same.
So, great month.
So, yeah, great month. Thoughts about those? Write in by January the 15th. It's always the 15th. Always duckfeed.tv/contact. Other things you can do. We plugged it a lot this time, but we have a lot of content on Patreon that you can go and listen to. You know, at $5, you get, you know, Real Lich Hours launching very soon. All of Bonfireside Chat, Unfilmable. At $10, you get Adaptation Decay. There's a whole bunch of those. Yeah, it's a bunch of stuff that we're proud of it. We stand by it.
Yeah, we think you'll like it. Thank you for your support. We appreciate you. As you're hearing this, we are very close to Duckstream.
Yeah.
December 1st through the 3rd. Tune in. What is that website, Cole?
It's duckfeed.tv/duckstream. There's also a banner on duckfeed.tv if you go. Do you have any content previews you want to do? Like stuff people can look forward to seeing?
We're doing a Pass the Controller Elden Ring randomizer.
Nice.
We are doing a Family Feud. Gamers versus Musicians Family Feud. Me and my wife are making the board for that. I bought a buzzer. I got a brand new costume and some characters I've been working on. I think Gwen is going to play Inscription, which I'm excited about. The Casey's mod for that. Doing karaoke. Will is going to play some Fortnite with Nick. Which I had one of those things. I felt bad about it. I had a gut instinct reaction of like, oh, I guess if people like it, but that was just me not liking playing games like that without realizing, oh no, of course people want to watch it. It's one of the most popular streaming games in the world. Like I'm the weirdo here, not anyone else. So, we get to watch, you know, get to see the Batman Who Laughs, who is, as far as I can tell, the main character of Fortnite.
Nice. I'm going to be doing other stuff in addition to this, but one of the main features on mine is going to be the Half-Life 2 Chaos mod, where Twitch chat viewers can vote on random effects to be brought in. They're very mean, but they're also absurd, such as there's one effect called the beer I owe ya, which it just spawns in the largest beer bottle that the environment that you're in can allow technically.
That's great.
They've got the double barrel shotgun where the shotgun shoots two exploding barrels.
Yep. That's phenomenal.
Yeah. I love it. Bunch of wacky stuff like that. There's definitely going to be some Jackbox. We're going to be doing multiplayer co-op with the Level folks, thinking about doing some Lethal Company on that. The hot new horror co-op game that everybody is posting GIFs of. So just a little indication of what you can look forward to for that. Of course, Duckstream is our 48-hour streaming event. Do it every year. This is the 10th annual, raising money for the Transactive Gender Project out of the Lewis and Clark College. It's a great cause.
Also this year, I just want to give the shout out. We have a couple of guest streamers coming through. We're still getting the very schedule, but a couple of the crossover points. Jeremy Greer will be streaming with Chris, his partner from Monster of the Week, and their brand new podcast.
The X-Files one, yeah.
Yeah, the X-Files one. Non-Human Biotics, I believe is the name of that.
Okay.
And I think they're playing Resident Evil 4.
Cool.
Which is exciting. And then Zach Handlin, our friend, a writer for the AV Club, has a good Patreon on his own, does Voyager recaps and stuff. We'll be doing some streaming as well for a couple hours. So. Yeah. I'm looking forward to 11-hour shifts.
That'll be nice.
It'll be nice. In addition to also just, you know, it's good to, people want to help.
They do.
And I think it's awesome. Like I, you know, I just people want to help. So, give if you can. If something happens and you cannot give, we understand, but please spread the word. Please tune in. Do what you can. It's a great cause. And it's the day after Trans Day of Remembrance.
Yes.
You know, this is more important than it's ever been. And we're, spoiler, we're not going to see the end of the importance of this in our lifetime.
Nope.
I would love to be optimistic and think that we're going to get there, but I don't necessarily feel we will. Mm-hmm. It's important to, to give and help out.
Like specifically this organization does, provides resources and education for trans youth, their families and their communities. The primary thing is like workshops, like, you know, when a young person, you know, is trans, they will like go and do like sessions like at their school.
Or like, you know, if a trans person is at a school and the school does not know how to work. With that, this is exists in part to answer that question.
Yes.
You know, Jen will go and she's a very giving woman and is, you know, a real hero, has given a lot of her time to educating people. One of the things I love, you know, this is already running long, but I started saying it. I'm feeling sappy because I'm sleep deprived. One of the things I love is that, you know, I'm cis. You know, my experience with having trans friends and knowing about this stuff has been a learning experience. Jen is endlessly patient. You know, I'm not like running around throwing out slurs or anything, but I've had questions and stuff. You know, it is a different walk of life, and she is a phenomenal educator. And takes on that burden of being patient. You know, and does it professionally. So yeah, to be supported, and we're happy to support it.
Yes. Wonderful cause, wonderful organization. So, you know, just, that is December the 1st through the 3rd, 48 hours should be a very good time. Great cause.
Great cause. If you want to support us, go on over to Patreon, as we mentioned. If you are a, not demographically identical to us, send me an email, gary@duckfeed.tv, with your stats and the project you'd like us to promote. We will. You can also leave us a rating review on Apple Podcasts or Podcast Addict, or tell your friends.
And join us in thanking Gwen, our producer.
Big thanks to Gwen.
Thank you, Gwen.
And we'll see you next week.
We will.
Shepard.